The average person spends hours a week at the grocery store, but you're not an average person, are you? There's a better way to get fresh groceries, and it's called Fresh Direct. Shop for just-picked fruit and vegetables, custom-cut meat and seafood, freshly made meals and meal kits, all your favorite brands, plus hundreds of weekly deals. Order Fresh Direct anytime, anywhere, and get the freshest groceries delivered to your door. Use code PLAYLIST to get $25 off your first order of $99 or more. Visit FreshDirect.com or download the app today.
Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone. My guest today is psychiatrist Dr. Kent Robert Shaw, a world-renowned expert in addiction. I'm your host, Jan Jaffe. Welcome to In Depth. Kent Robert Shaw graduated summa cum laude from the University of Pennsylvania, where he double majored in biology and psychology. He's a graduate of Cornell Medical School, where he received a special award for his research into the mind-body connection. He continues his connections with Columbia Medical School by teaching courses on substance abuse. He has over 20 years of expertise working in substance abuse. And as an expert in addiction, he has appeared on numerous television shows. His most important TV appearance was when he was a featured guest on the Oprah Winfrey Show discussing whether alcoholics can learn to drink moderately. He's appeared on CNN several times discussing topics including Michael Jackson's substance abuse, as well as the rise of prescription drug abuse. Dr. Robert Shaw appeared on Geraldo discussing alcohol and the holidays and was also interviewed on News Talk discussing the medical use of marijuana. He has also appeared several times on radio shows throughout the country. Most consistently, he has been featured over 20 times on the radio show The Positive Mind. He's been quoted in numerous magazines and newspaper articles. Dr. Robert Shaw has extended his expertise in addiction to include many different kinds of compulsive behavior other than alcoholism and substance abuse. This has included love addiction, sex addiction, food addiction, work addiction, etc. Using an innovative treatment approach, he has helped hundreds of clients stop compulsive destructive behavior who have failed other treatment modalities. He has an eclectic approach to psychiatry with expertise in various forms of therapy as well as psychopharmacology. Dr. Robert Shaw also believes in a whole-body approach to treating individuals with a sensitivity to mind-body connection, meditation, exercise, nutrition. He has a special interest in treatment of individuals in the performing arts. Dr. Robert Shaw was associated with the world-famous Juilliard School for many years. He has worked as an expert consultant on plays performed in New York, including High Life, featuring five-time Obie Award-winning actor David Greenspan. I'm delighted to have Dr. Kent Robert Shaw as my guest on today's show. Welcome, Dr. Robert Shaw.
It's so lovely to be here. Thanks for having me.
Oh, thank you. The number here is 646-716-9397. We welcome your calls, questions, comments, and contribution to the discussion. We would love to hear from you. The number again is 646-716-9397. So, Dr. Robert Shaw, there's so much I want to cover today, so I'd like to cover a few things quickly before we get into the meat of this interview. So first of all, is opiate use a relatively new phenomenon, or has opiate use or opioids been going on for hundreds of years?
Yeah, I mean, the lotus eaters from the Iliad, I mean, it has been known for centuries, if not longer, that poppy and opium is something that helps with pain and controls pain. So healers of all types, but certainly in the last 100 or so years, doctors, physicians, dentists have known very well that opiates are the best way to deal with pain of surgery, pain of dental work, or pain due to an injury, or pain due to some illness. So for, again, hundreds and hundreds of years, the connection between pain and opiates has been very well known by the medical profession.
I see. So then, there are a couple of other questions. So why has there been such a radical change then in the prescribing of opiates in the last 20 years?
Yeah, and if everyone in the audience, just to point that out, that again, that for most of the 20th century, there's been a sort of guidelines about opiates and pain and what's appropriate, what's not appropriate, and how it's used. And again, with maybe some notable exceptions of like famous people like Elvis Presley, who was able to get the opiates from a bad doctor or whatever. Obviously, that's always existed. But there was certainly a kind of understanding about pain and opiates and the appropriate use of opiates and various kinds of pain syndromes. And what's been clear that in the last 20 or some years, there's been an enormous increase in the number of prescriptions for opiates. So no one thinks there's more people in pain, there's not more accidents or surgeries or anything, that it has to be that doctors in the last 20 or so years are prescribing narcotics for pain syndromes that was not done in the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, or 80s, as the identical patient with the same problem would not have been prescribed narcotics. There's been a shift within the medical profession of a more liberal sort of prescribing for pain syndromes, particularly chronic pain, chronic pain, back, neck, stomach, headaches, and the like, of people, younger, under 65, under 50. And that's really been the big increase in the number of prescriptions, is people who have chronic pain syndromes and doctors, pain specialist doctors, prescribing narcotics ongoing for a chronic pain syndrome. And that's what's shifted. And now, why there's been a shift within the medical profession is not clear. I think there were some, research and articles that came out that said that it's helpful for chronic pain. Because, again, one of the ideas about why you don't give narcotics for chronic pain is because your body becomes quickly used to the narcotics. So one of the things that's guided people for centuries up until I went to medical school in the 80s and whatever was the idea that you shouldn't give people narcotics long term because of the problem of tolerance. The body quickly becomes tolerant to the narcotic and it stops working after weeks or months. So that you don't want to give it for chronic pain. You want to give it just for acute pain or an accident or something like that, because chronic pain, it'll stop working. And the only way to get a narcotic to start working again, once your body has become tolerant to it, is to increase the dose. And that was always the fear for centuries, which is that people would then need higher and higher doses of narcotics if they have a chronic pain syndrome.
Right. And then, of course, it can become, at a certain dose, it can become lethal.
Absolutely.
Right. And then, of course, they have been developing newer and newer opioids that are much stronger and then, I guess, more, in some ways, more dangerous, if we can use that word.
I use the metaphor of like alcohol. Again, if scotch is stronger than beer, but if you take enough beers, it'll do the same thing. I mean, alcohol is alcohol. In some way, opiates are opiates, right? They're opiate receptors. So the truth is, if you get a hold of a lot of 10 milligram Percocets, it'll do the trick, right? I mean, and people then, like Prince and people like that, were taking 20, 30, 40 pills a day of narcotics, right? So, again, stronger, stronger. They all work the same way. So you can use many of the narcotics that have been around for years, and all you need to do is just take more of them, and it will have the same effect.
I see. So why does the U.S., prescribe so much more than other countries? Why? I mean, I believe the number is 85% of the world opiates. Is that correct?
That's correct. So again, up
and
until,
why is that?
Yeah, up until the 80s or 90s, again, we were in line with many other countries, of the norm of other countries about how we treat pain. And again, what is just absolutely factually true is that the United States has gone off the bell-shaped curve of European, Russian, Chinese doctors in terms of a freedom of prescribing for chronic pain. We seem to be the only country really to think it's safe to do and that it's effective for chronic pain. That being the two things that sort of came out in the 90s by certain doctors, research and the like. And it seems to me, from to answer your question, I think a handful of doctors in the 90s seem to be partly responsible for the entire field sort of signing on and drinking the Kool-Aid of, oh, it is okay to take it long-term. And, yes, mm-hmm. there's tolerance to it, but it still works pretty well. And, yes, you know, people aren't going to run into trouble with overdosing and diversion of giving to friends and the like. They take it responsibly. Mm-hmm. They don't have problems with addiction, of misusing it and the like. So that's my sense. Because a lot of times people will blame the pharmaceutical company, which mm-hmm. never makes sense to me, since it seems like it's always been in the pharmaceutical company's vested interest for hundreds of years to have a lot of prescriptions to make a lot of money, whatever. So I think it's really been certain doctors or that really had a profound influence on everyone's thinking, you know, for a while. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, then, you know, general doctors, again, in 1998 who had a 37-year-old who has chronic back pain was starting to prescribe painkillers, you know, every month, something that wouldn't have been done in 1988, 1978, 1968, and isn't done in other parts of the world. You know, so the many doctors were then signing on for the idea that it's safe to do, it helps people, it helps their pain, it helps their quality of life, and it's not going to cause much trouble to the patient or trouble to society.
Mm-hmm. I see. I'm curious. These pain centers, you know, that they have in either hospitals or whatever, when did those come about?
Well, again, I think that's really been the last 20 years, that this whole mm-hmm. pain, and also, you know, a lot of pain doctors come from anesthesiology, right? So a lot of, you know, again, as you can imagine, going to an anesthesiologist for chronic back pain, you know, somebody like me would say, well, what does an anesthesiologist know about the physiology of the back, right? I mean, what's causing the pain, right? You know, it's and it's almost a kind of hopelessness about that we're never going to fix the pain, right? I mean, that's mm-hmm. also been the other idea, which is that we're going to get to the root of what's causing the pain, like a cavity with a dentist, right? I mean, you know, you're in pain where you have a toothache, and there's an idea the dentist is going to, like, fix the cavity and cure the problem that's causing the pain, as opposed to a sort of hopelessness that I believe happens when people go to pain clinics, where there is a feeling of, like, we can't fix your back, we can't fix your neck, we can't fix yourself, we can't fix 35, 45, 55-year-old. We're not going to be able to fix what's causing the pain. It's not fixable,
and there's nothing you can do and we can do.
Mm-hmm.
Right. No, and I'm just going to say, but sometimes you're told that you need to have surgery to fix something, and you know that's not always the answer either, because sometimes you can't fix, but you can do things yourself to bring down inflammation in your body. Because you're obviously very involved in the mind-body connection, and if there's things that you can do naturally to bring down inflammation, to bring down pain in your body, I mean, those are things to investigate too. And by going to a pain center, you're cutting off that possibility.
Yeah, I think that to make it, you know, to sort of be a firebrand psychiatrist here. And, you know, what became true is that doctors are human beings, obviously, and doctors have their own self-interest to do something that benefits them financially, right? I'm not saying they do this maliciously, but as you, the audience can understand that when a doctor prescribes narcotics to somebody, a young person, then the person has to come back every month or so, and the doctor gets paid, often by insurance or Medicaid or Medicare. You know, I don't want to sound like conservative, but trust me, there's like lots of money of our tax dollars going towards people, doctors and narcotics of people that, as you're bringing up, alternative treatments of chronic pain that don't involve the two things and the two only things that doctors have. We have a scalpel and we have a prescription pad. And lots of chronic pain isn't in that category. And it's not necessarily psychosomatic and psychological for Dr. Robertshaw, right? A lot of people need to go to physical therapy. They need to do biofeedback, hypnosis, acupuncture, stuff like that. Those are the mechanical treatments of what are often mechanical problems in their back and neck and the like. But that takes a lot of work, right? I mean, it takes a lot of, you know, perspiration and, you know, sort of stretching and strengthening and things like that. Whereas
it's not
tempting,
it's not a magic pill.
A magic pill or a magic surgery.
And, you know, another thing I just wanted to bring up, too, was that is it or ask you, is it possible, and maybe I am, well, is it possible that the rise in this country of the use of opioids is, or the prescribing of opioids for chronic pain is due to the way, you know, it's covered by insurance? I mean, you've already brought this up too, but I've been wondering, is, you know, it's that it's easier for insurance, and insurance, it will pay for it. It's cheaper to pay for that than visits to the to a physical therapist.
Absolutely.
You know, just pay for a drug prescription. So it's not about really how safe is this for the patient, but what is most economically feasible.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. I mean, I'm surprised insurance companies who have their own interest to make money, right? I mean, like doctors and like pharmaceutical, you would think that they would have their own interest in trying to get people to things that are maybe in the short term more expensive, physical therapy and the like, that in the long term, as you know, may help them save money, right? If somebody is caught having, again, you know, when you're on chronic pain medication, then you need a prescription paid for every month, and you need a doctor's visit every month, where very little happens, from what I understand. I mean, my patients who come to me to get off it will say, you know, they show up in a minute or two, maybe not even spent with the doctor. How's your pain? How's everything? Whatever. Oh, here's your prescription for Oxycontin, Percocets, you know, 90 pills, 120 pills, and we'll see you next month. You know, it's a real, like, mill of just come in, no evaluation, no real in-depth sort of discussion about what you're doing alternatively or otherwise to help with the pain. Just here's your script. You're not selling them on the streets. You're not misusing them. Thank you very much. Walk out the door, and that's it. And obviously, you talk about pain centers. There's notorious places in Florida and the like where it's clear that it's, you know, it's a whole industry of people who come from Oklahoma and other states where you can just come down there with a friend, and your friend says they have a backache and you say you have a backache, and you walk out of there with, you know, 120 pills each of, you know, very yummy narcotics, you know, to get you high or to sell.
Oh, gosh. That's just awful, isn't it? And it's not being regulated. I mean, well, I'm just curious, why can some people take opiates as prescribed and not abuse them or become addicted and others become hooked? Is there a genetic component of some sort?
Well, you know, again, I think there's and again, this was sort of what they were talking about in the 90s and the like, which is what they were saying is just because somebody's on painkillers and they're taking them responsibly, they are dependent on it, meaning they are dependent in the sense that everybody, all mammals, all people, Lynn, you know, Jan, Kent, Robert Shaw, if we took pain meds over time, it would stop working as well, and we would develop tolerance to it, right? It would affect us less. And then it would also show the other thing, that within a couple of months, we couldn't stop cold turkey, whatever dose it is. If we wanted to stop after 6 months, we would exhibit withdrawal from opiates, right? So a lot of people would say, well, okay, it shows characteristics of becoming tolerant to the opiate and having withdrawal from the opiate, but that's not addiction. That's not hurting their life. That's not a problem, even though they're physically addicted to the opiates. The problem being when people want higher and higher doses and go doctor shopping to get multiple prescriptions or go across state lines to get prescriptions and the like, to, again, the famous, you know, overdoses of Prince and Michael Jackson et al., you know, and obviously there's hundreds and hundreds of cases over the last year where people are taking, you know, extraordinarily high doses of these narcotic, these pills. And the question, I guess, is, you know, why is it that some people with chronic pain stay to a certain dosage of their pain medication and don't escalate the dose? And why are there other people that seem to, you know, quickly, you know, every month or so need more pain medication? And there's probably genetic differences in terms of people, you know, responding, becoming more euphoric. And then clearly where I come in is there's a lot of psychological and psychiatric sorts of underpinnings about why people are using their pain medication to deal with anger, frustration, boredom, all sorts of emotions. Because these painkillers, they make all pain go away, emotional pain as well.
Yes. And I've read articles as well about that that psychic pain, emotional pain, can also it affects the pain centers in the body, so that as I'd never thought about it this way, but that kind of pain can actually cause physical pain. So perhaps it is affecting their emotional pain. You know, like you said, it makes all pain go away.
You know, Freud, you know, cut his teeth, right, on, you know, pain and hysteria and the body manifesting symptoms for emotional problems. And there's no question a lot of people who feel emotional pain, I believe, right, manifest, they're not able to access their emotions and feelings to know what causes pain, but they have a need to communicate to the world they're in pain. And so, yes, because they're troubled and in psychic pain of a way that they can't connect with, become in touch with, talk about in therapy, get resolution from, they communicate, I'm in pain with physical symptoms, my stomach hurts, my head hurts, my back hurts or something, to communicate to people, I'm in pain. And clearly psychiatrists and psychotherapists would say a lot of good is done at times when people can connect to what really is hurting emotionally, so you don't have to use physical pain to communicate to people you're in pain, which is really what some bodily manifestations of pain is probably about.
So that's very interesting. So not only because I think most of us think, well, people get high from these drugs, but it's also that it's dulling just the pain of their lives rather than just physical pain.
Absolutely. Oh, yeah. And I think
Interesting.
And I think I've read studies that, again, a lot of people, if they're honest, of the, you know, the enormous number of Americans who get chronic pain medication, studies would show that a lot of people will admit that they took one of their pain medication, not because they're in pain, because something stressful, or, you know, living in New York City with subways that are stalled, or something like, you know, something very emotionally upsetting happened, and clearly, like other substances of abuse, they do work magically to make you feel better, like Johnny Walker and scotch and cocaine and cannabis. All these things are really magical ways to deal with emotional pain, and they work. You know, that's why there's so many addicts, right? They actually work. They calm you down.
So, you know, I'm curious, though, because you brought up addiction and tolerance, and I was wondering, it was one of the things I was wondering about, was the addiction versus tolerance. And the drugs prescribed that create tolerance, such as benzodiazepines and sleep meds, you know, and so don't physicians, and, you know, I'm not putting you in this group, but don't physicians add to the problem by creating dependent users by prescribing drugs to their patients that create tolerance? Just, you know, that when you look at the description on those little fold-out sheets that we all get that we throw away and never look at when we get a drug from our medication, and it says, do not prescribe for more than 2 weeks. And, you know, the doctor will give it, and we get prescription after prescription, and it's not like a sleep med that you're not supposed to take more than a few times, say, or something like that, and people will find themselves suddenly, you know, having built up a tolerance, and it's, and then you actually go through a withdrawal. So how is that different from addiction?
It is, you know, again, addiction implying, again, I guess, taking extra or, you know, taking more than prescribed, misusing the medication in that way, taking more than prescribed for anxiety. All the different categories you talked about, and you're spot on, right? There are many prescription medications that doctors are prescribing that, it is known that Ambien, which helped you sleep on night number one, on night number 150, is 1/8 as effective as it was night number one. And that Xanax you took because you have to do a radio show with Jan Jaffe and calm your nerves down, you know, that really made you relaxed and calm, you know, after 100 and some days of taking Xanax before a radio show, it's not working anymore. It's not calming you down. Now you got to take two to get that same initial effect. So, you know, it is true that doctors know that many of these medications, particularly tranquilizers, sleeping pills, and painkillers, that once you put somebody on them for months, that it's working much less effectively than when you started, and even darker, they're now hooked, meaning it's not easy to now come off once they've been on these things for months and months. It's very difficult to get off. There's often a withdrawal, a long, protracted withdrawal that we know with tranquilizers and painkillers, once people are on them for 6 months, a year, or plus, that it's as I'm sure many people in your audience know personally, it is not easy to come off these medications that your body has become tolerant to. It takes weeks or months to do it.
So then what is the difference then between, I mean, because it, cause if you are, say, it's sleep meds, or it is benzodiazepines or something, so you need, if you've created a tolerance, so then you need more of it. How does that differ from addiction?
Well, I guess in theory, right, you need more, I guess, within the idea that you're not, like, within your prescription, within your prescription, you're not taking extra getting friends or something like that. But to your point, it's like over time with the doctor, colluding with the doctor and a pharmaceutical company, mm-hmm. you are needing more, right? Over time, mm-hmm. you're saying, oh, my sleeping's not good anymore, or my anxiety is coming back, mm-hmm. or my pain is getting back. And then because it's the medical profession and it's a doctor, it's like, okay, well, let's give you 3 pills now. Mm-hmm. The second year you've mm-hmm. been on that, right? And yes, that would be, you know, you're increasing the dose, you're increasing the tolerance, all the above. And people like me would say, like, yes, you're now having a kind of opiate addiction or painkiller addiction or, I don't know, tranquilizer That's addiction. Maybe slightly different than somebody who's just, you know, taking 5 and going to a party on a Friday night, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's a different kind of addiction that happens all over the place. But mm-hmm. it's still, you know, people who are taking something that's now, you know, they got a monkey on their back, right? Meaning it's now
right.
very hard to come off, and they're pretty reliant on it.
Right. It's a dependence, and it almost sounds as though one is, you know, is within the, you know, the lines of being prescribed by a doctor and with a doctor's okay,
sure.
With a doctor's oversight versus, you know, outside of that world or,
right.
You know, or doing it, you know, going to a party.
Right. And again,
you know,
just to talk about doctors, you know, my colleagues, and I'm
mm-hmm.
one of them, right? But,
mm-hmm.
you know, there's a lot of evidence that when doctors feel there are people looking at their prescriptions more closely,
mm-hmm.
they prescribe differently. And meaning,
mm-hmm.
so again, you would think like, oh, everybody, Marcus Welby, everyone's perception of a doctor is they're smart and thoughtful and above all do no harm. Right, as
mm-hmm.
their motto, right? That's what the oath we take. Above all, do no harm. They're not going to do anything hurtful or something like that, or they're not just out to get money for their Hamptons house or something like that, right? You know, some people may have a more realistic or cynical view of doctors, again, being people who, you know, have their own interest to have patients come back and have patients be prescribed medications that, you know, benefits them to be hooked on because they need to see them on a regular basis. And one of the things that brought this aspect home to me about doctors and prescribing is in New York State, once upon a time, we were the only state in the country that went, not to talk complicated stuff, but, you know, you can, once upon a time, you could use a regular prescription pad for a benzodiazepam, a tranquilizer like Valium, Xanax, all the above, right? You can just use a regular pad, which isn't controlled or monitored very well. New York State was the only state, I believe about 14, 15 years ago, that then introduced that you have to put that prescription now on what was called a triplicate form at the time, which was the
mm-hmm.
form that you use for pain meds and other things that were more highly controlled and the like. And what happened in New York State after the year they introduced that is the number of prescriptions went down by half. Right?
Wow.
So the same amount of people were anxious and having insomnia and all the above. I'm going to pick a year, and I don't know what year it was, but I'm going to pull it out of the air. I should know it. 2001. So nothing's changed, right?
Mm-hmm.
Anxiety and insomnia didn't go away. But New York State doctors, knowing
mm-hmm.
that they're going to be looked at and monitored about how they're prescribing their tranquilizers, prescribed half as many prescriptions the following year, which shows that, you know, a lot of it is very subjective about
mm-hmm.
what doctors do with these things, even though they know about the problems of addiction and the like. You know, some part of me feels, to answer your question about America, and maybe people will disagree with me, but I say to liberals and conservatives, you know, I think we live in a country where we allow guns and we're now legalizing pot. Now, that seems to go on both sides of the political spectrum, right, of freedom. But it
mm-hmm.
may be true that America, right or wrong, has a very libertarian view which is, I know there's problems with guns. I know there's problems people are going to have with pot or prescription meds, but it's not our job to regulate it necessarily, right? It's America. Most people can take guns responsibly. Most people can smoke pot responsibly or whatever. And so, you know, why punish all the people who enjoy their guns and enjoy whatever for the X percentage of people that run into troubles? And that's partly also why I think we live in a country that has, you know, freedoms of things that other countries sort of act parentis locus. They don't allow guns, they don't allow prescriptions, opiates and the like, and clearly, you know, prescribing marijuana is, in the United States, is very much an outlier in 2017 of what is normal because of lots of other countries' concerns about what's going to happen when legalization of marijuana. But clearly also, I think, even with prescribing opiates, you know, it could be like, oh, 90-some percent of people, it helps their pain, they become tolerant, they have to come every month, but it's not causing real problem, where, yes, you know, there are this massive increase of overdoses that have occurred because of these prescription meds, and many of these prescription meds are making their way to the children in the household, and at 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, 21 years old, there is a lot more kids in high school and college on a Friday, Saturday night with their beer now taking a Xanax or a narcotic or a painkiller with their beer, because they're in their parents' households and whatever. They find them or whatever. It's easy to just take a couple out and use them and misuse them and give them to your friends. And that's a very scary idea as well, which is that now there's, you know, a whole generation of high school, college people who are being introduced to popping pills to get high.
Wow. That is kind of a scary thought. Although, I mean, gosh, I remember years and years ago people were doing downers and things, but I don't think it was probably as dangerous as what you're describing. I want to remind everybody here that we'd love to hear from you. The number here is 646-716-9397. And before I get to we have a wonderful sponsor here. And I do want to mention that here on the Life Coach Radio Networks, we're proud to have as our sponsor Audible.com. Audible.com is the leading provider of premium digital spoken audio information and entertainment on the Internet, offering customers a new way to enhance and enrich their lives every day. Audible is the preeminent provider of spoken word audio products that include more than 100,000 audio programs from more than 1,800 content providers. Receive a free audiobook with your 30-day trial when you sign up with Audible today at audibletrial.com/lifecoachradio. That's audibletrial.com/lifecoachradio. Now, here are some Audible books related to today's topic: Shame and Guilt, Masters of Disguise by Jane Middleton Moos; The Power of Right Believing, 7 Keys to Freedom from Fear, Guilt, and Addiction by Joseph Prince; and Emotional First Aid, Practical Strategies for Treating Failure, Rejection, Guilt, and Other Everyday Psychological Injuries, written and narrated by Guy Winch, PhD. So don't forget to sign up for a one-month free trial to get your free audiobook today at audibletrial.com/lifecoachradio. Audible, stories that surround you. And now back to our show. So I just wanted to ask you again, getting back to what you were talking about, Dr. Robert Shaw, what would you say is, I know this is kind of a ballpark figure, but what would you say is the percentage of people who use opiates or opioids who actually become addicted or abuse them?
I would say 5%.
Mm-hmm.
So, meaning misuse them and need higher and higher doses again. And within that, you know, are even just going to one doctor, but you know, again, some of these doctors in these pain clinics, you know, it's just remarkable that they're prescribing, you know, just an enormous amount of pain meds to somebody who is effectively being able to go in every few months, whether it's malingering or manipulative or not, and say, the pain's not working, and I need more pain meds after a couple of months, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and then get a higher and higher prescription. And then obviously the much, you know, the more common sort of thing would be people going to different doctors and getting different
right.
prescriptions as another
well,
way
I mean,
to get these high doses.
Right, right. Doctor shopping.
Doctor shopping and the like.
Right,
and, that's
and going
say,
for...
And it, mm-hmm.
Sorry, go on.
Well, again... And again, over, you know, again, when people see all these prescription overdoses and everything like that, again, it is not true when they look where these pills are coming from, right? They're not coming from labs, like in people's bathroom, like crystal meth labs, right? It's not being made illegally. So these pills aren't being made illegally of all this opiate addiction across America. And it's not necessarily the pharmacies that are, you know, some jar drops out of the back of a van to a pharmacy or something like that. So again, the pills are coming from doctors' prescription pads to patients, and then many patients, right, quote unquote patients, don't take a single of the pill, right? It's all a scam,
mm-hmm.
right? Like I mentioned before, mm-hmm. they walk out of the office with 120, 150 painkillers that are
mm-hmm.
street value now $30 a pill, and they sell them. They divert them. They sell them on the streets, or they sell them to people who sell them. So there's a lot of, you know, misuse of doctors and prescriptions getting over on doctors for people to make money and to sell pills and to sell pills to people who then need more and more. They get a prescription from the doctor, but then they need some from the street. You know, they need some from a drug dealer to get a higher dose.
Oh boy. You know, it's interesting that you say all of this because because of an experience I had. I wanted to know, first of all, what sort of regulations are there for pain doctors so that there aren't pill mills either masquerading as pain centers or pain centers transforming into pill mills? And I ask this because of an experience I had where I was referred to the head of a pain center at a major hospital here in New York City for a steroid injection. I was just supposed to have this steroid injection. And in this office, the office, when I went in to this pain center to get this injection, the office receptionist handed me this, you know, these forms that you have to fill out, and it was pages. And pages. And it was pages as I started looking to fill it out, you know, your name and your address and some questions. Then it was all this stuff, all these questions and information about opioids.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, how I would be, how about storing them, not giving them to others, how I would be refused further prescriptions if I discovered that I gave or sold my pills to others, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I looked at this, I thought, there has to be some mistake. So I went back to the receptionist, I stated to her, there must be some misunderstanding. I didn't come to the office for pain pills. But I came merely, I was there for a steroid injection. I'd been referred to that office by my doctor for a steroid rejection. She said, no, no mistake. Everyone who comes here fills out these forms. And I have to say, when I looked around the office, it did, some of the patients who were sitting there looked a little bit questionable.
Yeah.
You know, I don't mean to make a judgment, but they did look a little questionable. And so when
sure.
I got in to see the doctor, he did... he looked at my MRIs, and then he did his very best to convince me against the injection and to go on opioids. I flatly refused. I was furious and very upset. And as I left, you know, he said, "Well, you're not, you know, this." He wasn't going to give me an injection on that visit. And as I left, the receptionist asked, "Oh, so do you want to make another appointment to come in and come back and get the steroid injection?" And I said, "You know, there was no way I was coming back to that office or that doctor ever because I felt it was a pill mill. It was like a revolving door pill mill." And so what I feel, and you can hear, you know, I'm very passionately, you know, I still get upset about the way this was run and the way this office exists. And that if this is the head, if this doctor was the head of the pain center at a major hospital in a major U.S. city, how is our government dealing with this? How do they handle this? How can this exist? I won't mention the hospital. Obviously, it's New York City, but he is the head of this pain center at this major hospital. How can this be allowed? How does this go on?
Well, again, it's the medical profession. I mean, you hit it right there, right? I mean, mm-hmm. The medical profession has to police itself. I mean, we doctors, I believe, are not doing enough to, you know, get other doctors to either, you know, change the, you know, liberal treatment of painkillers to other people for chronic pain, or, you know, to sort of get doctors in trouble that we hear about are, you know, too liberally prescribing, you know, per Kent Robertshaw, right? I mean, obviously other doctors mm-hmm. disagree with me and think that everything's fine, right? That a lot of people are happier because of all these prescriptions of narcotics and the like, you know, that it's helped their pain, that they're happier in their lives, that they're not as troubled and distracted with their pain being on the chronic narcotics they're on, right? So I'm just telling you my view, which is, I think, yes, it's very self-serving of these doctors. And more importantly, I think that over time, again, and what Jen obviously is sort of saying, which you got to, you know, believe, which is, in no other time period before 1990 was it conceivable, and I don't even know what Jan's talking about, but I'm going to shoot from the hip, that it's inconceivable that a doctor would have said, put you on narcotics. Because in my mm-hmm. training and the like, mm-hmm. to keep it very real and honest for everybody, the only chronic narcotics were people with metastatic cancer and cancers mm-hmm. that mm-hmm. were going to most likely kill you within a few years. And then, in a very, you know, right sense, I think, people feel the pain is going to get worse because the cancer mm-hmm. is going to get worse, and the person's going to live for only a couple of years. So, yes, mm-hmm. the patient is going to develop tolerance, but who cares, right? I mean, we want to make them comfortable, whatever. And the underlying problem, the cancer, is getting worse. It's getting bigger. So their pain right. is actually going to be getting worse in an objective way.
Right.
Again, whatever Jan has or what a lot of people, it's quite the opposite, right? It's like, well, whatever this is wrong with you isn't necessarily getting worse, right? It's not like
right.
glowing, like whatever it is.
No.
Your back got to whatever it is for most people. And then secondly, you know, Jan's going to live another 40 years. So you're signing this. When Jan walks out of your office with this prescription, you could be signing her on to 40 years or more of being on narcotics. Because once she's on them, it's going to be very hard to get off.
Oh, he wanted another addict on his roster. I hate to say that, you know. And
right.
and P.S., I never had the injection. I just
right.
never did. I just went and found, you know, I did my research and found out how to reduce inflammation in my body. And I coach people on that now. How to reduce pain. Anyway, we won't go into that. I just want to remind people that Dr. Robertshaw would love to answer any questions you have. We'd love to hear from you. The number here is 646-716-9397. I have a question for you, Dr. Robertshaw, which may make me sound a little skeptical, but I'm very curious about this. If people can give up or stop using a substance via, say, a 12-step program,
mm-hmm.
then is it truly a disease?
I mean cancer, heart disease, epilepsy. One cannot apply 12-step methodology here. And yes, withdrawal is hell. But there is choice involved where there is none in, say, epilepsy or cancer. So why then is addiction labeled a disease?
Well, I think once the brain has been addicted, once the brain has been addicted to a substance, George Bush, alcohol, you know, one-third of the population, tobacco, many people, Philip Seymour Hoffman, Prince, Michael Jackson et al., narcotics, right?
Mm-hmm.
Once that's happened, then my viewpoint, and you mentioned my Oprah show about alcohol,
mm-hmm.
my viewpoint mm-hmm. is that now, like 12-step programs, you have to be sober. I mean, you have to have no
mm-hmm.
cigarettes, right? Former cigarette smoker. You have to have no cigarettes. Or if you're a chronic opiate addict, you can have pain meds every once in a while when needed for severe dental work or you get hit by a car or something like that. But it
mm-hmm.
has to be extremely monitored and extremely well controlled and looked at because, all these things, it's sort of like the brain is such that moderate use, recreational use, is no longer an option, that one has to be sober. And I think, again, I think the term disease would be that's that state of that brain, that if you have a drink, George Bush or maybe Donald Trump's brother or, you know, 10 million alcoholics, there's lots of them, you know, if
mm-hmm.
you have a drink, then something happens out of your control. And what I say to people is addiction is not a relapsing disease, right? It's a disease you have every day of your life, right? And to Jan's point, and I couldn't agree more, a person decides to have a cigarette after not having one for years or have a drink at a wedding after not drinking for 3 years, alcohol, whatever. And that's a choice. That's not your disease
mm-hmm.
relapsing, like multiple sclerosis and, lupus and lots of diseases that happen out of your control. It's a person choosing to do a substance. And then what I would
mm-hmm.
say is once that person makes that choice to do the substance after knowing they have the disease of a certain addiction, then their disease takes over. Then statistically, they're out of control. Right, they're off to the races, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that's where, and I think disease also implies that there's some genetic component,
mm-hmm.
and I think it's very important for people to believe it's a disease because what does it mean? There's something wrong with me. I'm weak-willed. Why can't I have a drink and yet my cousin can? And all the other thing would be, well, how do you explain to people? Well, why is it you can't have a drink if you're an alcoholic? If it's not a disease, is it an indicative that I have poor willpower or that I'm more neurotic than other people? If those are why I'm telling myself I can't drink moderately, that's very shameful, and the end goal will be to try to drink moderately or try to smoke moderately, God help us, or whatever. If that's why I tell myself I need to stay sober away from this substance. So I think even that aspect of a disease label or whatever is also a non-shaming way of
mm-hmm.
describing what people need to do, whereas I think a lot of people have very shaming reasons in their own mind, or other people have
mm-hmm.
very shameful, judgmental reasons about why you can't have a painkiller every once in a while, whereas other people can do it recreationally, and obviously with alcohol being the biggest
mm-hmm.
example of why can't you be normal and just have a drink every once in a while, like 85% of the population.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the disease is very important for people to feel at peace in their own head, that there's nothing wrong, bad, or morally wrong with them about why they can't drink normally. There's something that's happened to their brain that's not fixable, as I say. Or, you know, once a cucumber goes to a pickle, that you can't be a cucumber again, right? Once the evidence would suggest that once your brain has become addicted to cigarettes or alcohol or opiates, there's not a going back to moderate. That's what the evidence suggests.
Right. So it also, I mean, I love that image that you just put out there. But also, it's a very good way to psychologically get oneself out of shame mode, which can keep one from, you know, just staying stuck.
Right.
And actually going deeper and deeper into the rabbit hole, and basically give somebody some a little bit of pride or hope, and get them hopefully to move into action, and maybe to get into maybe taking some action towards self care, and basically being able to get away. It takes a lot of work to get out of addiction, to go through recovery.
And it is, you know, again, I like to say to people, you know, that addiction is probably the third leading cause of death in America. It's either third or fourth. You know, it's way up there, right, addiction. Not even, I'm not even going to use food addiction and obesity, which is actually I believe in, right? But just alcohol and cigarettes, right? It is thought to be the number four cause of death in America. And with that cause of death, sobriety, it's 100% treatable, right, with sobriety, right? Like, you know, unlike if Darwin or God gave you the cancer card or the heart disease cause, there's lots of other things that, you know, you can be cursed with that isn't so treatable, even in 2017, that will kill you. Addiction is such that Michael Jackson and Prince and Philip Seymour Hoffman and Heath Ledger could all be alive today. If they got sober and stayed sober.
That's absolutely true. You know, there was we're running out of time, but there was a show, and it's funny because I cannot find it anywhere on the internet. And I think it was Ernie Anastos who was hosting it. It was some special documentary about addiction and how it got labeled as a disease, and that it was basically the insurance industry who got it labeled as a disease so that it was covered by insurance. Now, I don't know if this is true. It was a very interesting show. But before it was labeled a disease, it was not covered by insurance. And that was basically the underlying reason, the motivation for getting it called and labeled a disease. But I've never heard the reasoning behind it so beautifully explained as the way you just explained how, you know, choice versus what happens after someone has made the choice to then have that cigarette again or have that drink or take that pill, what then happens and how the addiction, the disease, then comes back into play. There's just one more thing. I mean, there's so many more questions I have, and we may go a few minutes over. Is that okay with you?
Oh, of course.
Dr. Robert Shaw? Okay. I really do want to talk a little bit about medical marijuana. The Epilepsy Foundation has been working very hard to get it passed and available, since studies have found it to be far more effective than many of the anticonvulsants on the market today. It does not have the debilitating side effects, especially for children, that so many of the anticonvulsants have on the market. I mean, the anticonvulsants, so many of the drugs on the market right now make life for children, especially, but also for adults, almost impossible. And so many people have intractable seizures so that they can't function, or life is very dangerous, or they have multiple brain injuries. So they're trying very, very hard to get medical marijuana passed. And I believe it has been passed in New York State, but yet there are it's still impossible to get it, because there are no dispensaries or no growers. So it's still very, very difficult to get. There's still laws they're trying to get passed. And it's still a very touchy thing. It's so very helpful for cancer patients in alleviating nausea and increasing appetite. I mean, I just lost somebody very close to me, and I was his caretaker, and thank goodness he had access to marijuana, and because it helped him so much in his last days, just because the nausea was so bad. So I'm curious, what is your experience regarding marijuana as a psychiatrist, not just as a physician, but as a psychiatrist? Because I know, especially with the younger brain, you know, if you're dealing with teenagers, the developing brain, I'm wondering, what are your thoughts regarding marijuana and medical marijuana?
Well, you know, despite being phenomenally liberal socially and, you know, protested the Iraq War or whatever, much to my many friends' horror, I tend to be fairly conservative about marijuana in the sense mm-hmm. that the active ingredient for marijuana, THC, has mm-hmm. been available in pill form for 20 years, the active mm-hmm. ingredient. And those of us in the field and those of us in medicine have always wondered that if seizures and marijuana are very complicated, so that's a third rail, because mm-hmm. some research does not suggest it's as great a treatment. But wasting away syndrome of AIDS and cancer, unbelievably good for appetite. You get the munchies. Hello, we've all been there. Been there, done that, have the T-shirt to show it, right? I mean, you increase his appetite, right? So without a doubt, you know, THC, the active ingredient of marijuana, is very helpful for people undergoing chemo, with cancer, AIDS, whatever, where it's very important for people to have their appetite increase, because otherwise they're gonna start starving and the like. Now, where I, for years and currently, butt heads with people, is there's no other thing in medicine where the active ingredient of something isn't extracted and then, you know, made in a pharmaceutical. For example, opiates, right? We don't have mm-hmm. people who go to a dentist's office, smoke opium, you know, go to an opium den mm-hmm. and smoke it in a leaf form. They have the active ingredient, the opiate, in a pill form. They mm-hmm. have that in cannabis. And Dr. Robert Shaw has prescribed THC. He's pretty conservative about substances. But I've prescribed Marinol to people with cancer, mm-hmm. and I think it's done wonders for them. Now, mm-hmm. why we would want them to be smoking mm-hmm. cannabis with hundreds and thousands of other chemicals in there, rather than in a safe pill form, take the active ingredient, is astounding to me. I don't quite understand. I know people try to say it works faster if you smoke, but I could say that about opiate. I could say it about lots of other, you know what I mean? Like, there's lots of chemicals that we doctors use that are found in plants, right? You know, like anti-arrhythmic medications and stuff like that. And yes, mm-hmm. you could smoke a leaf if you have arrhythmias of your chest. You could smoke this plant if you're going in for dental surgery. There's nothing different about it, right? There's active ingredients in plants that medicine has been found to be very helpful. Why is this one and only active ingredient people pushing to have medical marijuana? And again, if people mm-hmm. go back 20 years when I used to debate this on whatever, to the head of normal, and it's come to be, well, it's to get the camel's nose under the tent to get marijuana legalized, which everyone now knows is actually happening.
I love the camel's nose under the tent. Actually, two questions come to mind from this. First of all, I'm wondering why then does the oncologist do not prescribe the THC pills or the Marinol pills, whatever it's called. They did not. They weren't prescribing that, because that would have been perfect.
I don't know why they don't do that.
Yeah, this was Sloan Kettering.
A lot of colleagues that I have at Cornell and Columbia prescribe Marinol quite a bit. So that's a
very
good
question.
Yeah, this
is Sloan Kettering. I don't understand that. That's why they don't. I don't. And as far as I know, with the Epilepsy Center, at least at NYU, that is very active in the Epilepsy Foundation. It's CBD oil, the cannabidiol, I think it's called. That's what they're talking about with that is very effective. That they use like just a drop on the tongue for children, and I guess for adults too, maybe two drops. They're not promoting smoking marijuana. It's this oil. And it supposedly does not get anybody high. So this is what they're trying to make available and get passed. So it's just very hard to get these things. You know, people want to be able to get this out there and get it available medically. So I don't know. Maybe what you're talking about is different than what I'm aware of.
I'm just not clear that the American neurological. It's good. This is good radio because we're disagreeing. But here we go. I'm not sure. It's clear that neurologists in 2017. The American Neurological Society said this is the greatest thing since sliced bread. It's like penicillin for whatever. I would assume there would be an avalanche of, like, Marinol or these oils or whatever. I think that there's still, you know, you got to be careful with what medicine and research and whatever, because, like, just what I said before about opiates. 1998, 1999, I was one of the very few people up at Columbia who was, you know, wary of some of this research that was going on. I'm telling you, I was like a dinosaur. Did you read this study, that study? So, again, I've been around enough to know this. A couple of studies and a couple of people advocating something is in medicine, right? Medicine has got to be science, right? There has to be many, many different centers, many different doctors, many different countries have got to replicate something. So just because, you know, a couple of doctors have found this to be whatever, that means nothing in medicine, in a sense that they could be wrong, like as I said about chronic pain, right? There were a couple of doctors in New York in particular whose research now, 20 years later, a lot of people say that they were wrong, and yet they had a couple of papers affected a whole group of people prescribing. So I think, again, and you might be right, in which case, every physician like myself who wants to help people, if it's true this cannabinoid oil doesn't make people high and it helps children with epilepsy better than known prescription medication, of course, I mean, we're all on board. But my spidey sense, if that was such a slam dunk, that would be happening by now. So something's more complicated. Other people disagree. Other people aren't sure. Other researchers don't find the evidence of cannabinoid and seizures as much as other ones. There's still controversy in the field, in which case there needs to be more research. That's my guess.
This is the Epilepsy Foundation, and they're trying to get more. It's just because there hasn't been enough research, apparently, for epilepsy research, and they're also working to get more funding for epilepsy research at the NIH. So there's a lot of. I'm not going to spend a lot of time talking about that now, but you know, I'll send you some information about this.
If it's the active ingredient THC, then why an extract from a plant with hundreds of chemicals in it? Why not just give the THC? That's what I don't know. And I don't think
I've never read that it's the THC. So it will be interesting to find out. The doctor who's actually head of all of this is Oren Davinsky. So you might find that interesting. But anyway,
to get back to our show, let me just, I've just another question. I have so many questions. I'm just curious. We mentioned patients who doctor shop.
Right.
And, you know, there are patients that do, depending on their mental state,
mm-hmm.
There are patients that, you know, they'll fake syndromes. They'll doctor shop and fake syndromes all the way to the point of actually seeking surgeries, you know,
sure.
Doing research and seeking surgeries to get opioid prescriptions. And until they can maybe come up with a syndrome that will, like CRPS, for example, and so they can get a, that's a, you know, for the audience who doesn't know, that's a chronic pain syndrome, a legitimate chronic pain syndrome that requires long-term or forever basically opioid prescriptions. And so basically, how does the medical field deal with these patients? Diagnoses, or you know, how do they deal with these patients? Is there a way?
No, you got to be very savvy, right? I mean, and if the doctor's spending 45 seconds, as your experience, whatever. I mean, you know, you got to be very, very savvy and suspicious or something like that. I mean, I think a lot of doctors don't like to be, like I would say, like a good accountant. To use this metaphor,
mm-hmm.
a good accountant, right? I run a couple of pizza shops here in New York, and I made $70,000 last year. Now, trust me, a lot of accountants will be, that's great, I'll fill out your taxes, right? But a good accountant should be like, that's weird. You're getting a lot of cash and not telling me about or something like that, you know? But then that's adversarial. Then you walk out the door. I'll get another accountant, right, you know? I own 10 pizza shops, and I make $70,000 a year. Like, do your job. And do my taxes, right? So an ethical, thoughtful accountant or an accountant
yeah.
that's worried they're going to be scrutinized, if there's that kind of scrutiny, but
mm-hmm.
an accountant would be like, I didn't do anything wrong. The guy came in with 10 pizza places, and he said he made $70,000 a year. And I looked at his receipts and whatever. I didn't ask about cash. He didn't tell me about cash. I don't know if he's lying. What, am I going to call my client a liar? And trust me,
mm-hmm.
a lot of doctors, you know, that's very uncomfortable for doctors to do. Very uncomfortable addiction
right.
in general to
mm-hmm.
probe about alcohol use or drug use or
mm-hmm.
whatever. A lot of physicians want to be liked, and they want to be, you know, helpful. And I'm asking questions that are annoying you. You know, implying
mm-hmm.
that I drink too much or I'm misusing my pills, and that's annoying me. And I'll go to another doctor that won't ask those questions.
Mm-hmm.
So it's as I tell medical students, you know, diagnosing addiction, you know, patients are happy to say this is what hurts and this is my thyroid or whatever. And often doctors, to identify addiction and the like, they have to be in the uncomfortable position of asking their patients questions that are going to make their patients uncomfortable, particularly if they're an addict, right? Particularly if they're an addict.
Mm-hmm.
And doctors
mm-hmm.
aren't used to doing that. That's not comfortable for them. As I try to teach the students, I say that's essential, right? If you want to be a good physician and you want to make this diagnosis, you have to be comfortable asking difficult questions and maybe even saying, I think I want to talk to your wife. Because your liver is a little swollen here, and you say you only have one or two drinks, and geez, Louise, I don't know. Maybe I should talk to somebody else.
So, what can we do if we find that we have either a friend or a family member that we realize is an addict? How do we handle this? I mean, they may seem like they have, you know, a relatively normal life. You know, and I'm using the word relatively, but we realize that they are using, and we're concerned. What can we do about this? How do we handle this?
It's a good question. I mean, there's very little anybody can do, right? I mean, that's kind of Al-Anon. I mean, you could try to talk to the person and see if they think they have a problem, or, you know, directly bring it up and get the elephant out of the room and say, you know, because I do think, as you're saying, family members, right? These people, Prince, Michael Jackson, all these people, Heath Ledger, trust me, when they have an appointment with Dr. Robert Shaw at 1:12 in the afternoon, they are pretty sober when they come into their doctor's office. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. They're not stupid, mm-hmm. right? They're coming in bright-eyed, a little bit of pain, whatever like that. And it's the family members at 7:30 at night that are seeing them kind of conked out, right? You know, like mm-hmm. stoned or asleep when they should be parenting or something like that. So again, it's absolutely true that family members and friends, particularly family members, they're the ones that are seeing some of the negative consequences of the addiction. The doctors, the nurses, or whatever, they can't read minds. And if the patient lies, or the patient is in denial and doesn't want to admit that I fall asleep at 7:30 every night in my pasta, my face in pasta, and I can't take care of my kids because I'm on my fifth painkiller, there's nothing a doctor can do, right? Because they can't read minds or whatever like that, unless a family member comes in. And what I would say to people, confidentiality means I, a doctor, cannot say anything to you, family member. And over the years, I've emphasized this to people. You, the family member, are allowed to call a doctor up and say, I know you can't say anything. I know you can't even admit that you're treating my brother or whatever, or my husband or whatever. But I just want to give you an FYI that at 7:30 at night, when we have three children, my husband falls asleep in a plate of pasta because they're misusing their pills. And so, yes, you can communicate to the doctor and help the doctor to know the truth of what's going on. Not the truth the mm-hmm. patient is telling them, but the truth. And then, because mm-hmm. I think many people in the audience are like, yeah, you know, somebody I know is not doctor shopping, not whatever, but they're prescribed. They're 37 years old and they're on 5 painkillers a day. And mm-hmm. I know he or she sobers up and goes in and says it's working fine, whatever, but I see when they're misusing it and taking extra and whatever, or having a drink with it and getting, you know, really wild and behaving, mm-hmm. you know, horribly.
Mm-hmm.
But the answer is there's very little people can do to confront or help an addict out. You know, as they say, it's a self-diagnosing disease, and often it has to come from the person, you know, sort of saying they have a problem. Now, obviously, a lot of spouses in particular have to question why I'm not saying to them, I can't handle this, I deserve better than this, and you either stop drinking a case of beer a day or smoking pot all day long or popping pills all day long, or I'm out the door, you know.
Yeah.
That would be
yeah.
in the realm of enabling, in the sense that I just allow it to happen, as opposed to, unfortunately, it's a fairly blunt instrument I think most people have, which is, you know, either I tolerate this or I sort of give them an ultimatum that this is intolerable.
Yeah.
You got to get help or else.
Absolutely. Well, Dr. Robert Shaw, I want to thank you so much. We are definitely at the end of our show. We have gone over because, I mean, we could just go on and on. You are just a fabulous guest, and
thank
I have learned so very much. So I want to thank you, my guest, Dr. Kent Robert Shaw, for being on the show today. I'm Jan Jaffe, and it has been my absolute privilege to have been your host today. In addition to my solo interview show, I also host Think Tank, a roundtable discussion. I would be delighted if you would join us for the next episode of Think Tank on May 24th at 12 noon Eastern. And if you enjoyed Dr. Robert Shaw today, I'm delighted to add that he will be joining us on the Think Tank panel as a co-host, so it's an episode not to be missed. We'll be discussing the ramifications of obsessive guilt and the impact
it has on our lives. So do tune in. Dr. Robert Shaw, would you care to share any closing thoughts, advice, comments, or words of wisdom with our listening audience?
Well, again, we covered a lot today, but I think the main thing is that dealing with addiction is difficult psychologically because it means dealing with the emotions and feelings that one has tried to avoid with the addictive substance, and in some ways is a much harder thing to do than to pop a pill or go on to an escort service or to have a donut. I mean, it's much easier to do that. So it's a hard thing, but doable. That's the hopeful message.
Oh, thank you so much. And thank you for being on the show today. It's been such a treat having you with us. And I want to remind everyone, oh, thank you. And I want to remind everyone that you can find contact and bio information in today's show description. Now, I'm just going to take a moment to announce a few of our upcoming shows on this, the Life Coach Radio Network. On May 23rd at 8 p.m., you can't keep doing the same things and get different results. And on May 24th at 12 noon, Think Tank, 50 Shades of Self-Flagellation, Obsessive Guilt, and How It Can Paralyze Us. So thanks again to my wonderful guest, Dr. Kent Robertshaw, for joining me today and making this show a very special one. Thanks for listening. I'm Jan Jaffe for Think Tank. Tune in next time.
The average person spends hours a week at the grocery store, but you're not an average person, are you? There's a better way to get fresh groceries, and it's called Fresh Direct. Shop for just-picked fruit and vegetables, custom-cut meat and seafood, freshly made meals and meal kits, all your favorite brands, plus hundreds of weekly deals. Order Fresh Direct anytime, anywhere, and get the freshest groceries delivered to your door. Use code PLAYLIST to get $25 off your first order of $99 or more. Visit FreshDirect.com or download the app today. Hitting up the Hamptons or the Jersey Shore this summer? Don't waste tanning time at the store. Let Fresh Direct bring you everything you need for a delicious summer. Just picked fruit and vegetables, custom cut meat and seafood, and all your favorite snacks and drinks. You can even order from the beach and be done before the next song's over. Use code MUSIC to get $25 off your next order of $99 or more. Visit FreshDirect.com or download the app today.